Good afternoon. You're listening to the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, a podcast where we discuss all things related to migration and diaspora, with me, your host, Loxanne Harley. On this week's episode, we're joined by an absolute rock star of a guest, Eric Guichard. Calling in from his home in Maryland, United States, Eric is CEO of Homestrings, which he founded in 2012 as a web-based crowdfunding platform, which offered African diasporas access to investment opportunities. They raised over $25 million in capital from 5,000 members, which led to Eric being named, very deservedly, 2013 Entrepreneur of the Year and 2014 African Financier of the Year in the UK. Harvard Business School, of which Eric is an alumnus, even published a case study on Homestrings' experiences with diaspora-based crowdfunding, which you can find in the show notes. These days, Eric and Homestrings focus their energies on sharing their expertise and first-hand experiences by advising governments and private sector clients on diaspora investment. And I don't know how he finds the time, but Eric also sits on several boards, including the African Development Bank's Diaspora Investment Advisory Board and the African Union's Diaspora Initiative Steering Committee. Eric was therefore the ideal guest to give us an overview of diaspora investment and talk us through the state of play of the sector, including what both diaspora origin and host countries can do to catalyze diaspora investment, in addition to relating diaspora investment to diaspora engagement and migration governance more broadly. I definitely recommend listening closely to this one, as Eric reveals to us the few key priority actions that governments can take to really maximize the potential of diaspora investment. There's some linkages here with episode 2 on Doing Diaspora with Dr. Martin Russell and episode 4 with Mr. Remittances, Leon Isaacs. So tune into those if you haven't already. I had great fun recording this episode. Eric is so articulate and has such a unique perspective on the topic, no doubt informed by his own migrant and diaspora experiences growing up in Guinea, Senegal, and the United States, as well as his extensive professional experiences working in private sector asset management and as a sovereign advisor at the World Bank. As well as being the podcast's first American guest, Eric also happens to be the first fan of Arsenal Football Club on the show, which is really the only character flaw I can pick out in Eric and does make me second guess his judgment. Anyway, in spite of that, this episode is absolutely littered with industry-leading free advice, and I do hope you enjoy listening. Eric, welcome to the show. How are you doing? How are you doing, and where are you joining us from?
Thank you for having me. I am joining you from Maryland, where I currently live and have been stationed since the lockdown in March. Maryland in the U.S., which is about 25 minutes south of Washington, D.C.
Okay, where they make the cookies, right?
Yeah, they make a lot of cookies, indeed.
Actually, I remember when I went to D.C. last year, I was made fun of by the locals for pronouncing Maryland as Maryland, and I've since learned that it's Maryland.
Yes.
So, yeah.
American colloquialism, absolutely.
Exactly. And I think, well, everyone can hear from your accent as well that you are from the US. You are the first American guest on the podcast, so well done for that. But I know that's only part of your story. So I was wondering if you could start by telling us a bit about your own migration / diaspora background and experiences.
No, sure. Absolutely. So, yes, it is correct. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and of a African-American mother and an African father who met in France as students in the 60s. And I moved to Guinea when I was 6 years old, and lived there until I was 25, visiting from time to time my mother's relatives in New York every 2 or 3 years at a time with my brother, just to make sure that we maintained the American connection. I went to school in Guinea, then in Senegal, got my baccalaureate in at the same school where my father went to a Catholic school in Dakar, Went to university in Dhaka as well, at university, the famous university, Sheikh Anta Diop of Dakar. And then subsequently came to the US to complete my studies, and then subsequently work at the World Bank as a portfolio manager. I have been living in the US since 85, and married, three sons, one of whom is finishing up in college. But yeah, so, and I go back and forth. I have family in West Africa. I'm sure, as you know, from most Africans, families are all over the place. So I have families, in Southern Africa and West Africa and Central Africa as well as in France, of course.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I think that that's such an interesting background you have, and I'm sure that informs the way you work and think about diaspora engagement, diaspora, and the topic we're going to be talking about today as well. So that there's a bit of praise. On the other hand, I know one of your biggest flaws is being an Arsenal football fan, and just in case
I bleed Gunners. Yeah,
that's the downside. And just in case anyone is wondering what the relevance of that is, I heard the other day Kingsley Akins from the Networking Institute, he referred to football followings as kind of like diasporas themselves, you know, because they're networks of influence and affluence, as he puts
Absolutely.
It. So there's the relevance. And but I'm just curious, you know, what possessed you to take that decision to follow Arsenal?
I think that I joined the Arsenal diaspora right around the time that Henri joined. I think the magic of having Henri join that team at the time, and the coaching and Arsenal's place at the time in history was just ripe for me to join them. I don't think anybody had thought that they could be invincible in that magical, unprecedented year. Despite the lows, and this is where, you know, the whole diaspora thing really rings true, is when you're challenged, you stick together, you commiserate together, and you hope for the best, and you rack up wins wherever you can. And I'd like to mention that we are still polishing the FA Cup and the Community Shield for this year.
Okay, well, so I understand better now. You started following them when they were good. All right, let's move on.
Before they were good, and then they became good.
Okay, well, anyway, on to the topic of the day, diaspora investment. So for listeners who are perhaps not so familiar with the topic, what is diaspora investment? And why have you decided to devote what is a substantial proportion of your career and life to working on this somewhat niche topic?
Thank you for that. That's probably one of the best questions I've been asked on the topic in the past 15 years that I've been involved in this.
We try our best at the migration and diaspora.
To define what diaspora investment is, and then subsequently my commitment to it and the underlying reason. Diaspora investment is essentially capital that is being sent by those members of a community who have been sent abroad to put together a better life, in most cases being sent abroad to acquire education, professional experience, and then subsequently send back money to your family, to support them. So, those are remittances. Remittances are, in fact, investments. They're social investments. They're safety net investments. In addition to that, there's a portion of those remittances that is seeking, to earn a return, both an income return, but also a social return. So, for example, several of us, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, when we were at the World Bank, were looking for opportunities to invest in small businesses or property that would yield a return, but at the same time strengthen, you know, the safety net component that we're trying to build for our families. Where we are now is a much different world than we were back then. And, you know, I'm happy to say that we played a very small part, we being HomeStreams, the company that I founded in 2011 to channel investments from the diaspora into Africa. That the landscape today is very, very different than it was, you know, back then. Back then, I was shocked. In 2011, I remember attending a World Bank conference on African diaspora investments. And at the top of the presentation was my very good friend, also from the World Bank at the time, Dilip Ratha, who was a senior economist and head of the migration department. And he made this presentation on remittances. I had never heard of remittances in aggregate form, and the number just shocked me. And at the time, it was globally about $300 billion. It's now in excess of $500 billion. And what immediately jumped out to me was that this was patient capital. And beyond studying it, that we should be finding ways administratively to channel it into development finance. And I remember rushing back to my office. At the time, I was running another organization called Gravitas Capital that was managing central bank assets. I rushed back and I told my colleague, Christopher Ali, and I said, look, drop everything. I need you to do some research on remittances. And then from that research was born this concept of HomeStreams, which is a play on two words, homesick and heartstrings. But the essence of it was trying to find a way to give diasporans a credible a channel to identify, vet, collectively invest in transformative products, be it property, agriculture, energy, infrastructure, you name it. And the challenge was both. One, obviously, the administrative element of cobbling together small transfers in a way that was globally compliant. And then on the other hand, structuring opportunities in such a way that they were accessible to those small investors. And that's no small feat, particularly back in 2011, where the regulatory environment in the host country, in my case, the US, was highly hostile to providing access to non-registered investments, right? And registered investments are investments that have been securitized, meaning that they've been turned into a security and then placed on an exchange or registered with a regulator. And that's an expensive proposition for a country seeking to raise development finance. And so the majority of development projects are not listed on the stock exchange because they're still in private form, as it were. And that's one of the challenges that we took on. We were quite successful, I may add, and I'm happy to expand it. But that to me became a passion, that if you can invest in your own, that's more durable than third party capital that is subject to the political whims of the sponsors, right? I mean, today it's Trump with his anti-everything. Yesterday it was Obama with his yes to everything. And so the vagaries of that shift in policy with respect to development finance is something that could be completely circumvented by mobilizing diaspora capital that is sticky, that is patient, and that is voluminous. And this is transformative. This is transformative stuff we're talking about. Now, obviously, if you achieve that, you're changing the political dynamic, within the development finance space. And, we have scars to... to evidence that.
Fascinating stuff. And it also sounds like there was a bit of a light bulb moment as well that sort of Absolutely. Then drove that passion that you have for the diaspora investment. And could you perhaps just expand briefly on the role of HomeStreams? Because in my mind, I'm still not sure whether it is a kind of financial institutional vehicle itself, or a more of a kind of consultancy firm, mm-hmm. or a bit of both. So I was wondering mm-hmm. if you could
Sure.
No, your words.
Absolutely. I think that when we launched Homestrings in 2011, the idea was that we wanted to solve the problem, right? We wanted to be the platform through which individuals with their discrete amounts of $100, $500, $1,000 could look at a catalog of investments that had been structured prior and made it accessible for them to own a fraction of that project, earn a return on that project, and also be part of the social narrative of that project, right? And then create a community that could discuss investments, again, on this single platform. And we achieved that. We achieved that. We created a crowdfunding platform that was two-sided. So on the one side, you had investors coming in, being vetted per the regulatory filters. On the other hand, we had partners who fed to us investment opportunities that were transformative, everything from financial services to property to energy to housing, even education. And we then brought these two universes together through technology, through a web-based platform. And over that period between 2011 and 2016, we raised in excess of $30 million. We posted about 50 projects, invested in 35 projects, which represented about 13 different countries. We won numerous awards for innovation and essentially set the template for how do you connect with the diaspora, leverage the internet, and leverage crowdfunding. Our main goal was to be able to scale that proposition. But what was the biggest challenge for us was achieving access to the U.S., which is a country of immigrants, where the population is larger, and therefore achieving scale becomes a much easier proposition. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, the U.S. regulators were not amenable to the proposition because of existing traditional regulatory rules around investing in securities, which were, as I mentioned before, a big limitation. So we went to the UK and we essentially did a proof of concept for 6-7 years, which worked tremendously. And as I said, was a template for other platforms that subsequently launched after us. In 2016, we were approached by the Asian Development Bank and asked to advise them and their sovereigns on raising capital from the diaspora using diaspora bonds or other means. And so we took on assignments, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, discovered quite a bit of information as well as came up with some innovative ideas around migrant workers versus professional diaspora. And then the Asian Development Bank subsequently published those two reports, which are available online on their website. And they subsequently set up a unit called Promoting Remittances for Development Finance, which is quite transformative from a DFI standpoint and hasn't been replicated by any of the other DFIs. Since then, we've done 11 studies, feasibility studies, which gave us the opportunity to pivot out of crowdfunding into providing advisory and doing structured finance. So now, we're not only advising sovereigns and private sector on how to tap into migrant worker flows and professional diaspora investments, but we are designing investment products, which we are helping distribute to those investors.
Fantastic. So it's really great as well that you're able to take that experience, that hands-on practical experience that you gained from executing yourself. And then now you're able to use that and advise others who want to do a similar thing. I think that's a very sort of powerful string you have to your bow. And moving on to taking a step back to look at the big picture. When I think about diaspora engagement, generally, I personally often think about it in terms of the need for a country to get to know its diaspora. I guess it's, what I'm saying is it's a kind of process where a country needs to get to know its diaspora, then to build trust with them, and then to design ways through policies, strategies, and projects to engage the transfer of various capitals from its diaspora, you know, economic, social, cultural, and so on. So in that respect, I see diaspora investment as the economic piece of that puzzle. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I mean, could you describe how you see diaspora investment and how it fits into broader diaspora engagement or migration governance?
No, I think, you know, it's an excellent point. I think, you know, we came to the issue of diaspora investment narrowly because of, the challenge that we set ourselves, which was trying to close the investment gap, the capital investment gap that existed in development finance, and that was being, where essentially a bottleneck was created by those who control capital, right? So that was our main focus. And I think we've demonstrated through the crowdfunding phase of Homestrings that was achievable. Subsequently, you know, now we have several platforms that have launched since then. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think, Ireland is a very good example where, building relationships, building trust, having an outreach policy. I think Kenya, in the case of Africa, is a very good example where I remember in 2013, the government sent out, ministers and other policymakers to go out and meet with various diaspora groups around the world and engage with them on what their concerns are and what they want to see. That ultimately led to two major events in the case of Kenya. One is, the right to vote in domestic elections, which was unprecedented at the time. And then also devolution of power from the center to the provinces, which then connected the diaspora very closely to policymaking in the regions where they came from. And again, you're absolutely right. I mean, diaspora investment writ large is a multifaceted contribution. It's intellectual, in terms of, policy advice. Mahendra Modi, when he came to power in 2014, did, a very famous diaspora tour around the world, filled stadiums in the U.S. at 100,000 a clip, listened to the diaspora, particularly those who had risen to posts of influence, the two leaders in Microsoft at Google, those who were in policymaking positions, the former governor of Louisiana, and obviously the current vice presidential nominee on the Democratic ticket who has, Indian heritage. And so listening to these people makes a significant difference because it broadens the understanding of issues such as geopolitics, access to resources, et cetera. And then more importantly, in the case, the very specific case of Ireland, which again, I've seen being replicated elsewhere, is leveraging diaspora relationships for the benefit of the country. I think Ireland's amazing diaspora incentive of linking introductions to monetary compensation for jobs created was phenomenal. And the result of that program, looking at IDA results, in excess of 200,000 jobs have been created as a result of that kind of product. Similarly, because of the trust factor, diasporans tend to react, as we say in the U.S., through their pocketbooks. India was able to amass in excess of $35 billion in diaspora deposits in the bank. That's transformative. Between 2014 and 2019, India has been able to achieve that. So, I think that your point is absolutely correct. From a policy standpoint, it makes sense for governments to engage with their diaspora initially to make sure that there's a meeting of the minds, that there is trust, and that there is a listening element to the experience gained. There is no more engaged to provide free advice than the diaspora. right? Because he or she has a vested interest. His family or her family comes from a certain village. They have sacrificed for them in order to access, a better life. And in return, many diaspora, maybe to a person, want to see the country from which they hail do well. And you see that that's the common thread, whether it's an Irish person, a Zimbabwean, an Indian, or a Brazilian for that matter.
I think, yeah, I totally agree. And I guess one reason why I asked the question, or the genesis of the question, also comes from some of my interactions with governments who tend to have, in some cases, this fixed objective of trying to, in inverted commas, tap into diaspora investment for economic development. And what I say to clients as well is that there's a bit of a two-way process there as well. It's not just about getting resources from the diaspora, but a broader relationship, which also involves the country of origin or country of heritage doing something to support the diaspora, their diaspora as well.
You're absolutely right on that. I think part of it is that they also are recently, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, discovering the power of the diaspora. I mean, much hadn't been written formally on these things for one reason or the other. But now more literature is being is being created that showcases, for example, Kenya and the Nigerians were the first to have diaspora banking, right? Where, they've gone out, reached out to the diaspora, asked them what they need back home, understood that they want to provide safety nets, that they want to have access to information. They want a say in domestic politics. And that two-way street is extremely important. But it all starts from trust building, and trust building takes time, right? Many of the successful countries have been successful because they've been able to establish that trust element. In some cases, a result of an election, right? In the case of India, in the recent case of Ethiopia with the Prime Minister Abiy, and hopefully in the case of Zimbabwe. So that element is extremely important. Sometimes you might have the right policymakers, but they may not have an interest in engaging with the diaspora in a supportive and a consistent way. And I think they need to be brought around so that they understand the importance. You go to Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, most of those countries, whether it's Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and others, have a two-pillar economy. One is inherited textile for the most part, and then the other one is remittances, right? So remittances highly depend on the engagement of migrant workers, and because of that, many of those countries have been able to thrive. But again, the engagement is not simply on money transfer alone. It's making sure that they're taken care of when they're working, when they're working abroad. It's making sure that the diplomatic relationships between the host country and the home country are aligned, to protect these migrant workers. It's making sure that when they come back, that they're treated, as very important individuals. I mean, if you go into the Philippines or you go into Sri Lanka, there's a red carpet line for immigration that is specifically reserved for migrant workers. That is part of that sort of non-material element in terms of managing that very important relationship with the diaspora.
Very well put, Eric. And what I like about you as well is that you've got such a geographically diverse portfolio that really gives you that global view. And just hearing you pull out all these different examples from across the world, I mean, it's just, it's invaluable. It's invaluable expertise to be able to provide. And I'm very glad that we've managed to get some of that expertise for our podcast listeners.
Wonderful. Happy to contribute.
Yeah, thank you. And another question is, when clients come to you and ask how to increase diaspora investment, what are the key pieces of advice that you give them? Or perhaps, priority questions that you advise them to address?
Yeah, so I mean, piggybacking on the previous question, my first question to them is, what's the status or the nature of your relationship with the diaspora, right? And also the next step to that is, you know, finding out from the diaspora associations around the world. So getting a sense of where the diaspora clusters are. And in some cases, you can have a firsthand account through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs about where they're getting the most engagement through the embassies. Reach out to those groups and get an understanding of what the nature of the relationship is, whether they're friction, there are issues of friction, or issues that they would like to see. So that leads to the next set of questions around what is, and this is extremely important. I just wrote a report on Ukraine about this. It's extremely important to understand what is the regulatory classification of the diaspora, particularly when you're talking about engaging on investments. For the most part, particularly in Africa and obviously to with respect to Southeast Asia, the majority of the diaspora are deemed to be retail investors, meaning that they fall below the threshold of what's called an accredited investor, a qualified investor, who the regulators, the host country regulators, deem to have sufficient enough sophistication, again, to invest in non-registered investment opportunities. And that creates a massive block, because if you're only restricted as an emerging market country, if you're only restricted to the pool of capital that so-called accredited investors can provide, it's a very small group. You're talking about, in the case of the US regulator, you're talking about investors who have $1 million in net worth minus the value of their primary home. Or in the case of the UK and in Europe, you're talking about individuals who work or have a professional understanding of investment risk. That gives you a very small universe of people that you are allowed to contact and promote, you know, a bridge, a school, a power plant, an agricultural, you know, commercial real estate, et cetera. So that creates a very, very significant limitation. And that then broadens the conversation as to what are the investment structures and strategies that make sense to approach these type of diaspora investors as classified by the host country regulator. Extremely important. Now, you know, I personally have been beating this drum in the US and abroad for a very long time. Some of the regulators have somewhat come around to listening. My understanding is that the one of the SEC enforcement division officers at a conference in Nigeria as part of a diaspora bond conference seemed to have suggested that the SEC is happy to listen to propositions that will help them better understand how to reclassify diaspora capital as being development capital and not necessarily investment capital, only seeking a return, particularly in the context where, you know, those diasporans have a better understanding of the intrinsic risk of their country than some of the people who are running around with, you know, financial licenses. So, you know, there's hope there, but again, there are strategies that we have recommended and developed that essentially, in a compliant way, get around this particular problem, particularly given the fact that the majority of diasporans fall below that very high investment accreditation threshold. And so once we arrive at that point, then it's a question of looking at what type of investments the government wants to promote, getting a sounding board from the diaspora groups, whether they're interested in those or how to structure those. And then that subsequently leads then to, you know, what kind of promotional strategies are needed, et cetera, which gets into some more detail around financial structuring.
If I may ask as well, when you have those conversations with host country regulators, what sort of advice do you give them, or what sort of changes are you lobbying for, in the sense that presumably the regulations that make it more difficult for ordinary members of the diaspora to invest in, I don't know how best to put it, the less accredited, the non-accredited investments, presumably those controls are in place to minimize the risks of people getting ripped off or losing their money, right? Minimize the risks of quote-unquote unsophisticated or less sophisticated investors being ripped off and losing their money. So how should they change these requirements or relax them in a way that allows them to invest in these diaspora investment vehicles or investments back home, but also ensures that they have, you know, the right protections, or that the less sophisticated investors are protected?
Yeah. So excellent question. I think what's important to point out is that many of these so-called security rules were established coming out of 1929, right? So where obviously there was a vast fraud, several large rafts of populations, particularly in the U.S., were defrauded by, at the time, Wall Street, and sold stocks that were worthless, et cetera. The point being that, you know, we now have tools to mitigate risks that are readily accessible, highly transparent, and that allow individuals to take proportionate risk to their ability to take risk. So for example, crowdfunding is a very good example, where upon registering as a member of a crowdfunding platform, you have to determine what your ability to take risk is, right? And that can be cross-referenced, right? A whole bunch of ways. Subsequent to that, with that information at the platform level, you can limit the individual to a certain size of investment based on the platform's assessment of that individual risk. So for example, if I am a migrant worker working on an oil rig off of the Middle East, and I hear of an agricultural investment opportunity or a fintech investment opportunity in the Philippines that my parents have been telling me about on WhatsApp, and I want to participate, my income is, say, $25,000 a year. When I am shown the platform that is distributing that opportunity, I then register and I let them know what my income level is, you know, where I'm working. There's generic data available to determine what my risk appetite could be as a migrant worker working for Shell. You know exactly what the average income levels are. You know how they're being paid. And you know, in essence, from a benchmark standpoint, what their obligations are, you know, back home as a model. So you can easily say, for your classification, being a private platform, we will limit you initially to only $100 per investment and no more than $1,000 in any one particular year. Now, they may object to that, fine, and then, you know, not register and go away. We would have, as a platform, met our fiduciary responsibility with relative to that individual, and then report on that to the regulator, correct? So then you are disaggregating the risk management responsibility and really giving individuals and the private sector the opportunity to manage that risk. I mean, we are all attempting in this space to do the right thing. I mean, there are obviously some risks. Nothing is guaranteed. And if and when something goes wrong, the risk to the party is limited to what they can afford to lose, which has been quantitatively determined. And I think those kinds of approaches make a lot more sense, or a lot more progressive. Treat individuals as adults. I think this is important, as opposed to having a paternalistic, broad-based view, which is exclusive of, and particularly in the case of development finance, which is exclusive and not inclusive of those who really want to participate and really understand the underlying risk. So my conversations, I mean, I haven't had conversations with the regulators. And, you know, I'm not sure if you know, but in the U.S., you don't have a conversation with a regulator if you don't have to. And I have a funny joke about that. When we launched Homestrings, our PR firm had done a magnificent job at getting Homestrings to gain mind share, particularly in the UK and in the EU. And whenever someone spoke of diaspora, Homestrings was most likely the second word that would come out of their mouth. I did get a phone call from the UK Treasury, and I can't remember the lady's name. She said that she had seen a conference at which I had spoken. I think it was at the Lancaster House in off of Pall Mall. And she wanted to know if I could stop by the UK Treasury, you know, for some tea. Now, when you get a phone call as an American from a regulator, your next question is, do I have to bring my solicitor with me? Right. Luckily, it was a very pleasant experience. And what they were interested in finding out had more to do with understanding what a diaspora is and how different is a diaspora from a regular investor. And then hopefully, you know, we've imparted that.
Fantastic. And glad to hear the UK regulators are a little bit more open and collaborative.
No, absolutely. I really enjoyed the Earl Grey. That was very nice.
Excellent. Okay, so moving on, I mean, what countries would you say, or I guess what exciting things and what exciting developments have you come across in the past few years in the field of diaspora investment? Because I mean, as you said, it is quite a new field in a way, quite a young and emerging field. So particularly given your global view, I mean, what are the things you're excited about?
I mean, you know, I'm going to throw some kudos here to a few platforms that have done magnificent work in their own spaces to really carry, you know, the mission forward and, you know, connecting the diaspora, you know, to opportunities in their, you know, in their home country. And if there's been a significant amount of fundamental change in the space. One, obviously, the fintech space with challenger banks allowing people to open up accounts all over the country to send money for free. I can be here. I can download a challenger bank app on my phone, open up an account, send a message via WhatsApp to my relatives in Kenya to open up an account themselves, and I can transfer money, you know, very cheaply, you know, to them. The receiving bank can also give me access to a slew of investment opportunities, whether it's for pension investments, bill pay, etc. The example of M-Pesa, you know, comes to mind as a transformative product in Kenya and in that region. On the venture capital side, I have to mention Cairo Angels, a venture capital platform that focuses on creating an ecosystem between tech ventures in Egypt and diaspora investors all throughout the world through this web-based platform. That is, you know, quite successful and quite transformative. I also have to mention, you know, the folks in the Netherlands with the VC for Africa and what they've done to create the knowledge base, you know, through in the early days meetups, now through identifying angel investors to match with underlying entrepreneurs. You know, these things are transforming, and then there are a slew of other examples. I think technology.
Just a quick side note: I can put links to those organizations.
Yes, no, absolutely. And there are several others as well that don't come to mind quickly. But I think at the center of this transformation is the judicious use of technology, right? And I think that has been very transformative. And I think that's where the future lies, whether it's in financial services, whether it's in investments, you know, whether it's, you know, the ability of the diaspora, you know, to manage the quality of life of his or her family back home through, you know, a tech dashboard where they're paying bills, they're contributing to, you know, insurance coverage, they're funding pension and retirement funds, they're buying property, you know, upgrading property, listing that property on Airbnb, all from, you know, the comfort of their kitchen table in the host country. I think that's the future. All at the same time, you know, being active professionally in their daily lives. I think that is a future. I must also say that I was really impressed with what Ireland did. You know, coming out of the 2008, among the countries that were struggling, Portugal, Greece, and Spain, Ireland really stood out as an innovator in leveraging the diaspora, and the results were phenomenal, were absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it went from struggling to becoming a corporate hub. You know, within a decade, and that's amazing, and that to me is a model that is readily portable to other countries, and is anchored in that trust element that we were talking about earlier.
Fantastic, and well, and also, what is your take on things like diaspora bonds and diaspora investment funds? I mean, that seems to be more your background as well, and you've done a lot of feasibility studies, and I feel a lot of countries are looking at diaspora bonds. Not that it's a new issue, but you know, Nigeria had their successful one a couple of years ago, and I think Ghana's looking to do one. Ivory Coast, I think, as well, are looking into it. Anyway, what is your take on them? Or perhaps briefly, also just explain what we're talking about and. Also, what was your take? How and when should they be used?
Yeah, so the concept of diaspora bonds emanated from Israel, you know, back in the 1950s at the founding of the country, and the need to tap into the Jewish community around the world to help found and finance the growth of the country, the newly established country, and also protect it, obviously, with this constant existential threat. As a major pool above and beyond the religious links. So from there, the question was, you know, can other countries use the same instruments to mobilize capital, you know, above and beyond remittances to specifically finance projects that feed to development transformation. Some countries have succeeded, others haven't throughout the years. In part because you know, there's been issues that we just talked about, disparities between the diaspora and you know, and the policies in the country, or because there have been regulatory constraints which the country did not understand, or you know, there hasn't been an important focus on marketing and awareness campaign, sustained awareness campaign. But there's also something else which again is linked to that dichotomy you know, imposed by the host country regulator, which is you have retail investors, and then you have essentially high net worth investors. The instruments that are being proposed and then obviously promoted by the likes of the World Bank and others is that it's the holy grail tool to raise capital. In our 9-year experience at Homestrings, you know, looking at over, you know, 10 to 15 different cases, writing up about 11 of them, two of them we currently are working on. Diaspora bonds per se are not the holy grail, or a diaspora fund is not the holy grail. It is one of several different instruments that should be considered and used as a way of mobilizing capital from the diaspora, take into account the, you know, the regulatory disparities that we talked about. And so, for example, and this is pre-consulting, for example, for retail investors, the, you know, the low-hanging fruit is their interface with a banking institution. Whereas for high net worth investors, you know, they do have brokerage accounts. They're active investors in the stock exchange. So a natural target for them would be a security. And if that security is a diaspora bond linked to a particular project, that makes sense. Similarly, those individuals, to the extent that the funds that they're that are being proposed or unregistered investments or vehicles, then that also is, you know, should be directed only at high net worth investors or accredited investors. You know, if the target is retail investors, then those structures, those vehicles should be registered on an exchange, hopefully duly registered, assuming that there's an exchange back in the in the home country. So these regulatory issues are extremely important, but they also unlock, you know, other possibilities, right? So for example, mutual funds that are listed in the home country, but also available in the host country, for example, or investment opportunities that are sold through bank accounts that are opened by the diaspora domestically, right? So if I'm from Guinea and I open an account with a Guinean bank, and the Guinean bank shows me investment opportunities in Guinea, well, yeah, I will instruct them to move some money into whatever vehicle that gives me exposure to those investment opportunities, to the extent that I feel comfortable that those domestic investment opportunities are well-structured, transparent, et cetera. So again, when we are recommending, we've moved beyond suggesting simply, diaspora bonds or simply diaspora funds. We are talking about a range of investment vehicles and propositions that reflect our analysis of the makeup of the diaspora of that very specific country or very specific region in some cases.
Yeah, it seems to me, and please do correct me on this because I'm not a diaspora bond specialist, of course, but or an diaspora investment specialist, but it seems to me that these vehicles exist to, one, market directly to the two diasporas. So it seems to me that in part it's a kind of marketing play. Two, so that they are regulated by regulators that diaspora investors have confidence in. You know, like the Nigerian diaspora bond was registered at the with UK and US regulators, and there's also the currency element as well. But I don't know, are these fair points? And I guess I ask that because I also think if the country of origin can give their diasporas, if they allow dual citizenship, and if they allow their diasporas to open bank accounts and have some sort of residency in their current country of origin, that surely would enable them to invest directly through investment vehicles in their country of origin. So, yeah, what yes. is yeah?
Go no, ahead. No. So, I think your last point says it well, and that to me would be the holy grail.
Yeah.
Right. Because then you are capturing the intention of the diasporan. You're using a common denominator, irrespective of the regulatory classification in the host country. High net worth individuals have bank accounts. Retail investors have bank accounts, irrespective of their regulatory status. Now, the question is whether the banks back home have the wherewithal and the sophistication to offer products and services that are reflective of the opportunities that exist back home. And again, that then you're going into a financial sophistication of those various institutions. And in many cases, we've seen those institutions come under a lot of pressure from the diaspora to actually, bone up, as we say in the US, in terms of their services. Some of them have responded extremely well, like the Nigerians and the Kenyans, and then soon, as I understand it, the Ethiopian banks as well. And in Asia, we're seeing further advances in that, where Facebook through WhatsApp is going to be offering free transfers linked to digital accounts in those economies back home, and those accounts linked to a range of investment and other financial services. So that to me is the next generation solutions beyond diaspora bonds and diaspora funds. Which are, to my mind, very limitative.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very interesting. Okay. I'm going to put a bit of a general, broad question out there. and it's for you to interpret what it means, but what are the common myths about diaspora investment and also the common mistakes that are often made in interventions to attract diaspora investment?
Yeah, I think I'll take that from two angles. The first one would be from the sovereign angle, and then the next one would be from the private sector. I think one of the common myths that the sovereigns have when they are approaching the diaspora is that the diaspora owes the country, and that the government need not expend any energy to engage with the diaspora, because the diaspora owes it to their country to make contributions without being called upon. That is a mistake. And I think more and more countries are realizing, following the success of, you know, all these countries that we talked about, that no, you need to cater to the diaspora. You need to listen to the diaspora, because they have experience, they have knowledge, they have, you know, they have things to contribute above and beyond capital. And so that's one. The other myth with respect to the private sector is that income is unlimited, right? I remember when the Kenyans were doing a blitzkrieg on European-based Kenyan diaspora. And they were doing so with the belief that they were that there was unlimited pools of capital that the diaspora controlled, and that irrespective of where they lived, those pools of capital could be tapped into. The reality is that those pools of capital are limited. I mean, I know that the World Bank and some other sources have placed aggregate savings of Africans living abroad at about $35 billion. But, you know, there are also approximately, you know, 35 million Africans living abroad, right? Mm-hmm. So then when you break it down, it's not necessarily a lot of money. In aggregate, looks big, but, and so what this basically says to the, you know, to the private sector is that you need to refine the products and services that you are offering, taking into account the realities, both in terms of income generation, in terms of savings, and in terms of obligations. And that opens up a whole new universe of products and services. If you understand that you're contributing to the quality of life of the diaspora by offering services that are supportive, you know, to those needs. I think those are the two major myths, I think, that that to me stand out. Particularly when it comes to when it comes to Africa, you know, the other one which we are trying to figure out, which is a brand new myth, is understanding what is going on with the ever increasing flows of remittances, irrespective of COVID. I think it's common knowledge for the past few years that remittances are counter cyclical, in the sense that if there's economic strife back home, remittances tend to increase because people send quote unquote emergency money. In 2008, we saw that countercyclicality was challenged and shed a light on the nature of the work that generates those remittances. So for example, when you look at the disparities coming out of 2008 in terms of remittances, between El Salvador and Jamaica, you notice that in fact, the reason why remittances dropped precipitously in 08 in El Salvador, but were relatively stable in Jamaica, was because the Salvadorians who live in the US work in housing and in blue collar jobs, such as, you know, gardening and masonry and the rest, and were heavily hit by the housing bubble and the bursting of that bubble. Whereas Jamaicans, one of their number one export is nurses and doctors. And that, you know, that particular profession tends to be relatively stable, and therefore the income was not necessarily dramatically hit, at least on a relative basis, you know, compared to El Salvador. But now we're in a different environment where we're trying to understand why remittances are rising given the uniform impact of COVID, particularly following the lockdown, right? You know, people could not work. Essential workers, you know, were exposed disproportionately to this this virus. Yet, you know, Mexico is receiving record remittances, topping $30 billion run rate at this stage, and they cannot explain where that is coming from. We're seeing similar things happening in Southeast Asia, where remittances are, whether it's Bangladesh or Malaysia or others, and they cannot explain what is happening because the conventional wisdom is that COVID has impacted most industries and most people have either lost income or have had curtailed income. And so the question is, what is being sent? Is it savings? Is it punctual fiscal stimulus? That question is still out and is still a mystery.
It's really interesting, actually, as you've described, to look into the details and get down onto the national level within some of the macro data that we apply to the world. And yeah, it's a fascinating insight as well about how the countercyclicality, I can't really say the word, but how that doesn't really apply when a lot of migrant workers are particularly hit by an economic recession. Okay, well, I'd really love to get more free advice from you, but unfortunately, we're going to have to bring this to a close. So how can listeners learn more about your work and connect with you and Homestrings?
Yeah, so we're working on a couple of sort of second-generation Homestrings projects, which we'll hopefully announce in the new year. But in terms of connecting with me, I'm on LinkedIn under Eric V for Vincent Guichard, G-U-I-C-H-A-R-D. I'm happy to put my link there. And I think that's probably the best way to connect with me.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. Just thank you so much for your time, especially I think it's really great to have you on. You're such an illustrious career and so much expertise in this topic, and also extremely eloquent, well spoken, and you just managed to convey some of these challenging concepts in a very engaging way. So I think it's great to have you on. Just to sign off, Arsenal haven't finished above Spurs for quite a few years now. So I just want to pin you down to a prediction for Arsenal this season.
I think that we have found our manager. I think Arteta bleeds Arsenal because he used to be a player. He's won as well with the place. So he understands the culture, understands the mentality, understands football, Arsenal football. And I think you've seen the demonstration of that in the past two or three games in the opener of the season. I think the formula is starting to work. The FA Cup final, I guess, you know, we didn't do quite well in prior years, in part because of the transition. I don't think Arsenal has had the firepower in terms of acquisitive dollars or pounds to get the big players. You know, switching to Tottenham with a Bale in his waning days can be a transformative player. Maybe he can bring in the crowds. He can sell some jerseys, some kits. But whether that means that you guys lock in the fourth place or above, we'll see. But so, very hopeful.
Where's Arsenal going to finish this season?
I think Arsenal finishes. Part of the plan this season is that we finish fourth so that we get into the Champions League. Finishing fourth opens up a whole new set of opportunities in terms of players we can acquire, particularly players who want to play in the Champions League next year. That opens up potentially some big names who are eyeing the Premier League as a way of managing the end of their careers. Messi obviously made some noise about Man U. I'm not going to mention any names because it's still secret, but we have a few surprises that we're going to announce over the next over the next season.
Sure. Okay. Well, your prediction is on record, and we'll check back at the end of the season to see how accurate it was. Anyway, Eric, it's been a pleasure. You're the first Arsenal fan on this podcast. I made an exception.
Thank you.
But thank you. Best of luck, and we'll be in touch soon, no doubt.
Thank you. And again, congratulations on the podcast. Well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode of the Migration and Diaspora podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can check out the podcast website at loxanneharley.com/podcast. There, you can subscribe to the mailing list or get in touch if you want to be on the podcast. Be sure to follow the podcast via your favorite podcasting platform and leave a review if you can. Thanks again, and see you next time.